Welcome to the Abridged Presidential Histories with Kenny Ryan, episode 37A, an interview on Nixon in the domestic arena with Luke Nichter. I'm excited to welcome Luke Nichter to the show today. Luke is a professor of history and the James H. Kavanaugh Endowed Chair in Presidential Studies at Chapman University. He's written numerous books on the presidency and runs the website nixontapes.org, which is the only website dedicated solely to the scholarly production and dissemination of digitized Nixon tape audio and transcripts. Oh boy, what fun that must be. Today, we're going to talk about Richard Nixon in the domestic arena. Nixon, he was sworn in with a Democratic majority in the Senate and House, so you'd think that would be a recipe for impasse, but a lot of legislation came out of this administration. So what happened? That's what we're going to look at today. Luke, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. It's great to be here. I think this is a prestigious opportunity because you and your audience have been on quite a journey of the presidency here. So I'm very glad to kind of, you know, pound down this tent stake here for the Nixon period.
Thank you so much. We've come so far, and yet we've never found anyone anything like Nixon. He's such a unique guy. So thank you very much. So Nixon, he had come up through Congress, the Senate, and the vice presidency. So I'm curious, as he's moving toward the presidency, were there any major causes, domestic causes, that he was known for, aside from like HUAC? And if you wouldn't mind, please remind folks what HUAC was and what he was doing there as well.
Sure. Well, I mean, even my own students sort of get HUAC, the House on American Affairs Committee, on American Activities Committee, confused with the sort of the broader McCarthy era. So who, you know, was McCarthy part of that, or kind of where does he fit in and what else is going on? And they also get that kind of mixed up with, was that like his chambers, you know, that Nixon was involved in? Right. And so, you know, the way I look at it is the country is occasionally, we often define ourselves by some external threat or enemy. And a lot of times it seems like we get along better as Americans when we agree on the nature of that threat. So during the Cold War, you had a lot of ideological overlap between the Democrats and Republicans because you always had a reliable number of anti-communists in both. And so anti-communism was the major feature of that HUAC era. It was a Red Scare. You know, we had a first Red Scare after World War I. A concern after the Russian Revolution in 1917. But of course, the Russians became our friends, sort of, you know, during World War II. But then, you know, after 1945, in the wake of World War II, we were again kind of on opposite sides. We dropped the two bombs in Japan. They developed a bomb by 1949. That really scared us. Now the possibility of a, you know, nuclear atomic World War III was within possibility to create an Earth that no one could live on in the future. And so really that era became very concerned about domestic groups that could be supported by the Soviets, influenced by communists. Certainly if you were a member of the Communist Party, that was not a good time, you know, in politics. Yeah. And our nation really didn't experiment much with socialist or Communist Party members as, say, even our allies in Western Europe. And so in the House, you had HUAC, and Nixon was a junior member on that. And probably the most famous part in terms of his role was the allegations against Alger Hiss, a State Department figure prominent under the Truman years, that he had been a communist or associated with communists. And the allegations were made by Whitaker Chambers. And Nixon sort of, you know, doggedly kind of followed this story. I say to my students, it's really a life experience for Nixon that defined a lot of his political assets, but also his political liabilities. Mm-hmm. And probably for every friend he made at least that many enemies.
Yeah.
And the most notable part of it is this sort of, it's been called the Pumpkin Papers, where apparently the proof that Hiss had copied these State Department documents and taken them, smuggled them out of the State Department, was supposedly in this microfilm that Nixon found in this pumpkin on a farm in Maryland. And yes, it is that odd. Like we really don't still, I think, have the facts for how exactly that happened.
Right.
And so McCarthy was off in the Senate investigating communists, ultimately leading to the army hearings. When I did the Henry Cabot Lodge biography, Lodge suspected that McCarthy's real target was actually Eisenhower himself. Because McCarthy was a conservative Republican. Eisenhower was part of what I call this is a bit, you know, strange, the moderate to liberal internationalist wing of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And did not support Eisenhower in 52. McCarthy supported Taft And Mr. Republican Robert Taft had been steamrolled by Eisenhower and Lodge and Brownell, the gang around Eisenhower that really propelled him to the White House. And so McCarthy's army hearings really disintegrated his own support, because I think Lodge suspected that, you know, that McCarthy was investigating a time period when Eisenhower was actually the Army Chief of Staff and would have been knowledgeable and had signed off on discharge papers, even of suspected communists. And so Lodge and those around Eisenhower suspected Eisenhower was actually the target, and they needed to shut him down prior to that. So I think that really is, in a nutshell, the McCarthy era. And Nixon's part of that was his role on HUAC, including the Hiss Chambers case.
Fascinating. And so this is what Nixon's really known for when he's a congressman coming up. Was there any domestic cause that he was associated with? Anything that he championed? Or was he just known as, I'm an anti-communist guy, and that's what I'm growing my career on?
Well, I guess it's interesting because, you know, today we, you know, anybody who likes politics, and if you're, I don't know, breathing air in 2024, you have no choice but to have a reaction to what's going on. But, you know, we use terms like liberal and conservative and progressive and even Democrat, Republican, because they help us to organize our thoughts and kind of figure out where people stand. But those terms have changed meaning over the years a lot. And, you know, you don't need to go back to your earliest podcast to see where they were really different in some case, and the political world was kind of upside down. But in Nixon, I always tell my students, don't think about this in 2024. You've got to take yourself to the context of the time. And for a Republican coming of age in the 30s and 40s, you know, as Nixon was, Nixon campaigned for the first time in Congress in 1946. He called them, Republicans at that time called themselves practical progressives. I don't know how many Republicans today are calling themselves progressives, but what that meant back then, okay, what does that mean? What it means is that, you know, Republicans in the 40s were blamed for being the party of no. You know, their only answer to FDR and the New Deal is they were against all of it. All of it was terrible. Yeah. And so a practical progressive meant you weren't against all of it. What you hope to do is either make it a bit more efficient or maybe shade some of it towards a Republican or a sort of market-driven realities and not just big spending bills and make it a bit more accountable, I think, was that generation. And to answer your question pointedly, I think that's who Nixon was, but also his rise was so quick. You know, he wasn't around anywhere for any point of time to champion much. I mean, so the House was a lot of anti-communism. He established his foreign policy footing on the Herder Committee as a junior member, which made the recommendations that led to Marshall Plan funding, aid to Greece and Turkey, support of NATO, what became the European Community, and Marshall Plan funding. But, you know, he was only in the House for two terms, from 47 to 51. And then he reaches the Senate, you know, while he's still in his 30s, running in 1950. I mean, it really is one of the most linear, rapid rise. It's right up there with TR and JFK. And then, you know, by early 52, he's only in the Senate for less than 2 years. And there's talk of, you know, as far as I haven't been able to nail it down exactly, but as far as I can tell, it was Senator Henry Cabot Lodge approached him on the Senate floor, Senator Nixon, and said, what would you think about the idea of being on the ticket with Eisenhower later this year? Ooh. And Nixon said something like, sure, who wouldn't? Eisenhower was a hero, you know, a bigger figure, bigger than politics. And so he'd really only been in government at that point less than 6 years. And so it was, I would say it was anti-communism, and then it was establishing his foreign policy footing. But, you know, so to conclude the thought, you know, so much has been written about Nixon as this partisan, visceral figure who sort of crawls out of the sewer every 4 years to campaign for someone or something. And you know what? I say to my students, he is Tricky Dick. But I think in hindsight, the question is, was he really trickier than his contemporaries? Ooh. When it comes to the Johnson, when Lyndon Johnson was the master, the Kennedys were better than anybody at winning and keeping what they got politically. But you have to remember, and this takes hindsight to reflect on this, Nixon came out of the Earl Warren wing of the California Republican Party, who considered himself a practical progressive. I think he was pragmatic more than anything. He shifted right when he needed to, and he shifted left when he needed to. But I can't do any better than his own description. I mean, he really considered, he was on the moderate to liberal internationalist wing of the Republican Party.
So when it gets time for him to run for president, and he did this many times in his life, so your choice of which one, What was the domestic philosophy or agenda that he was running on? And I suppose, you know, did it change during his different runs for president?
Yeah. So of course, to refresh your audience's memory, so he lost narrowly to the presidency in '60 to JFK and LBJ, and about a 500,000 votes in the popular vote. But of course, we decide outcomes in the Electoral College, where it was a bit more decisive in '60.
Yeah.
But it's still, I mean, it used to be said it was one of the closest elections in U.S. history. But I think for young people, every election's close these days. I mean, since 2000. And in some cases, you have the loser of the popular vote more than once who wins the Electoral College vote. So that distinction of the closest election is a bit, you know, being blurred, you know, for younger people who are really going to carry the ball down the field for us in the future in terms of shaping our future history. And then he loses more decisively and in humiliating fashion in '62 for the California governorship against Pat Brown. And no, still today, people debate, well, could you imagine a vice president, you know, in a way taking a demotion and running for governor? I mean, California had just passed New York as the most important state in terms of population in 1960. So it was not, that's an important job, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's still a mystery. I mean, most of us couldn't imagine, say, Vice President Harris stepping down as vice president and running for governor. You think, like, is that really a step up?
That's a great point.
Like, what's the thought process there? And I think the closest I can guess with Nixon is just what Eisenhower wanted him to do. And this is not on the public record. You know, Eisenhower believed to be president, he was old-fashioned. That shouldn't surprise your audience. You needed to have executive experience to be president. And for him, that was the military. You could also get it in corporate America. You could get it by running a large cabinet department like state or treasury, which really it's a big management job, like almost like a corporation. Or he thought you could be governor of a large state. Nelson Rockefeller in New York. Why not Nixon in California? To continue the Eisenhower moderate to liberal internationalist tradition in bicoastal fashion.
So
he loses in more humiliating fashion in '62. So I look at it like this, to answer your question. I think Nixon ran a bit more to the left in '60 within the framework of the Republican Party. His running mate, Henry Cabot Lodge Jr., was a bit more to the left even of him in '60. Mm-hmm. Nixon and Lodge promised the first African-American in the cabinet if elected. No one dared say such a thing. I mean, that was an absolute third rail issue. At a time when JFK still had segregationists on the dais in LA, like Orville Faubus. This was a different time period when really Republicans were known more for civil rights until LBJ passed the Civil Rights Act of 64, Voting Rights Act of 65, and Democrats take that mantle largely away from Republicans because especially Southern Democrats are moving by the millions out of the Democratic Party and they become Republicans. So it flip-flops during that time period. And so I think by '68, after the Goldwater wipeout in '64, one of the four great landslides of the 20th century, so you see Nixon lost being a little bit too liberal, I think. Goldwater lost for being too conservative. Nixon thought, my political lane needs to be somewhere in between them. So I think he ran much more as a moderate. His view, though, to your point, Nixon, I always say, is in a way really the end of the line of kind of the liberal presidents. Because you think about it, and if you know, I mean, I always knew grandparents who talked about living through the Depression and how hard that was. And I'm not from privileged stock. We're kind of blue collar, lower middle class, Midwest, first generation college grad in my family. My high school was surrounded by cornfields on three sides. You know, everybody was in a union. We were Catholic, so the Kennedys were saints. You know, grandparents had pictures of FDR up on the wall. And so the way I look at it is I think, you know, Nixon, it wasn't until Reagan where it was kind of the joke that government is the enemy. I mean, he said those words and it's become a joke. It's kind of like, hi, I'm from the IRS and I'm here to help. You know, but Nixon was really the end of the line where the helping hand of government had a duty to help people and lift people. And so I think that was Nixon's philosophy that changed during kind of Ford and Carter. We thought to question it. And then from Reagan forward, it's really been a reversal where, you know, I think no one gets elected these days by promising bigger government. I mean, obviously Democrats still lean more in that way. But even then, it's all mixed up. I would say since Bush 43, both parties are big spenders So again, this even Republicans with their traditional kind of small government principles, I think, have not necessarily put their money where their mouth is in the last 20 years.
What did the two parties stand for domestically back in 1969? What were there, today there's clear domestic policies, whether it's gun control, abortion, taxes, you know, what have you. What were the big battle lines in 69?
Well, in 69, you would think this is ancient history, right? This has been 55 years. This is not. This is really cutting edge history. And I say that because today there's really not a comprehensive book on Nixon's domestic policy. Yeah. Well, I would argue there's not a definitive biography of Nixon. I would argue there's not a definitive book on Nixon's White House years or of Watergate or of all the intelligence stuff that went on in the mid-70s. And so this is really, you know, this is cutting edge. And so I'm going to go out on a bit of a limb here and say, you know, I think if you look at the modern presidency and you look at any two presidents, one that succeeded another, I think it would be hard to find two other than Johnson to Nixon where so much of the previous president's agenda was unfinished. You know, Johnson planned to run again. And so not just the war, you know, leaving 500,000 troops deployed in Southeast Asia, but so much of his domestic policies were contingent. And I think in the future, it could be 10 years, it could be 50 years, I might not be here. If I am, we'll have to come back and do another podcast to really make sense of it. You know, it used to be 50 years was enough time to look back, and you kind of can make sense of things. But it's taking longer. Government secrecy is bigger. People live longer. It used to be about 30 years. Everybody was dead. The records are opened. Let's go dive in and figure out what really happened. It's taking longer. It's really 50 to 75 years now. But to answer your question, you know, I think a lot of the ideas, especially domestic ideas, you know, of Nixon's his agenda and his presidency, the seeds were planted in LBJ's. You know, and a lot of his ideas weren't original. Now you can say that in a way, none of our ideas are original. We're, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants or whatever analogy you want. But I'll give you an example, and I printed out a small list. You know, I used to go to the LBJ library a lot. In the gift shop, they sold this T-shirt, which had all these words on the front and the back. I didn't know what it was, and I went and looked at it, and I realized in very small print, it was just a list of the most important pieces of legislation during his administration. It was incredible. I mean, it looked like a dense crossword puzzle on the front.
Right.
And Nixon's, I think, now, I don't know that a Republican presidential foundation would make a T-shirt and be proud of it in the same way.
Right.
But
right.
don't forget, I think you could make a similar case for Nixon domestic policy. And I think also the size of government didn't shrink under Nixon, a Republican. Mm-hmm. It grew even after Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. And so I'm just kind of going down the list here, just a few bullet points. And a lot of these, and I admit, Nixon did these things with the help of a Democratic Congress. Yes. House and Senate had nearly veto-proof majorities, so he had to cooperate. They'd forced them to work together, ending the draft and giving the 18-year-old right to vote, peacefully desegregating Southern schools, restoring treaty rights to Native Americans, quadrupling the number of women appointed to high government positions, breaking the inner-city heroin epidemic. That sounds relevant today, except for it's not cities, it's everywhere. Minority small business investment corporations, kind of bringing venture capital and marrying that with minority businesses, signing Title IX to help women's sports.
That's huge.
Which has obviously grown much beyond Nixon ever could have imagined. Perhaps he's rolling in his grave to some degree. Supporting the environment by creating the EPA, NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, signing Clean Air, Clean Water, Marine Mammal Act, Endangered Species Act, Anti-Ocean Dumping Act, really launching the telecommunications revolution. This is kind of where C-SPAN comes from. And the internet and all these kind of telecommunications, cell phones, kind of comes out of research that started in the 60s and went into the 1970s. Again, it doesn't mean that I'm not saying Nixon invented the internet, but it was a time of creativity and research.
Yeah.
And he was willing to commit funds to research even without a predetermined outcome or result.
Right.
Restoring, revenue sharing, pushing down
taking federalism, the idea of kind of pushing down power down to the states and local communities. He didn't spend less on welfare, but he wanted to distribute it more efficiently. Mm-hmm. Instead of giving a big chunk of it to the bureaucracy to administer, he experimented with, how about direct payments to the recipients who need it? How about experiments under Pat Moynihan as his urban affairs advisor, talking about a negative income tax, family right. assistance plan? I mean, Ted Kennedy, I recall during the Affordable Care Act, or we know as Obamacare, said yeah. our best chance to get national health care was under Nixon in 1974. And Nixon's own party wasn't really supportive. And the mm-hmm. Democrats didn't want to give Nixon support for getting it. So I think that kind of broke down due to dysfunction in both parties. But also, you know, really, I could go on. But that gives you a nice
right. It's a long list.
All over the place.
So, and I'm curious, you mentioned this about how Democrats did hold such huge majorities in Congress and the House. So how did that influence Nixon's legislative strategy? You know, these things you mentioned, how many of these were Nixon ideas? How many of these were Democrat ideas? And he's just going along because that's his strategy to how he's going to have a successful presidency when the other party holds Congress.
No, I think that is the number one question. You know, these days we have a bit more of a visceral reaction, like, oh no, the House or the Senate is the party opposite of
right.
the president. Because I feel like now we're in this, the battle, the stakes of the battle are so much higher, and we're kind of in this nightmare scenario of our founders that anytime the House is in the party opposite, we are in a permanent, you know, impeachment scenario, at least potentially. But again, look at Nixon's time period. You know, the Democrats had controlled the House for 40 years from the 50s to the 90s. They occasionally had the Senate, you know, for brief periods. But, you know, they were considered the party of government, of domestic policy. I think it was a more natural fit for the Democrats to be in charge in the House and Senate. So I think what seems to us as odd or dysfunctional or divided was more normal to a politician of Nixon's time. And I think the second point, you know, you know, I think any historian, I could take my answer back to the Greeks or the Romans, maybe. But I mean, let's go back to James Madison. I think the founders, in a way, expected government to be divided. And yeah. they saw government as really producing its best ideas when compromise was a reality. And these days, compromise is a pejorative, a kind of dirty word. None of us wants our side right. to compromise because it sounds right. like we just sold out.
You feel like you're losing instead of focusing on what you're winning.
And compromise means you're going to have a primary challenger.
right. Yes.
On both sides. So I think under Nixon's time, it was really, more natural to have divided government. And I've even seen some limited studies that I remember at the beginning of Bush 43, when the Republicans had House, Senate, and presidency. And more recently, under Obama, when the Democrats had all three, or Biden, they actually get less done. Mm. And now, how do you define less done? I mean, you can look at it mm-hmm. different ways. But I think it's natural. I think the reason why the founders had three co-equal branches of government, the president is the leader of one, not the leader of all, we forget that, mm-hmm. is because we expected there to be at least some part of that to be controlled by the other side. And so I think divided government was considered to be a natural. And specifically, I'll answer your question. I don't know if I've listened to all the Nixon tapes, but if not, I've listened to the majority of them. And I would say probably, and this is very, you know, back of the envelope, I would guess half or two-thirds are foreign policy. Because Nixon considered him, it goes back to commander-in-chief. There's no substitute for a commander-in-chief. A president has to make foreign policy, especially during wartime. Now, domestic policy, our Constitution is not clear what the role of the president should be. So right. Nixon focused on top-level issues, expected the rest to be outsourced to trusted advisors. Maybe a 30% of the tapes are domestic policy, and then the remaining 10% are kind of politics, administration, and so forth. Domestic policy, unlike foreign policy on the tapes, is not always a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Where you can see how the idea, the seed was planted, it takes right. root, the options were considered, and even in some cases, how they reflected after the fact. But domestic policy is one where I would say sometimes the ideas came from Congress, but the tapes also show that a lot of times Nixon was the one pushing. You know, when it came to negative income tax or family right. assistance plan or single-payer health care later in his administration, you know, those ideas were also being driven by the White House, by advisors like Pat Moynihan. I mean, Nixon, you know, Nixon is one of the most, you know, I think, stereotyped political leaders.
I think he froze.
He was anti-Semitic. He was an anti-communist, this dogmatic leader. But he surrounded himself, you know, with Jewish Americans and Ivy League people that he supposedly disdained. I mean, so Nixon is a, almost a caricature at 30,000 feet. But when you begin to really look at the detail, I think it's much more complex.
You mentioned Eisenhower earlier, and I'm curious how much Eisenhower was a model for Nixon, because you look back to Republican presidents he could have looked to. Before Eisenhower, you got to go all the way back to like Hoover, who's not a great, you know, role model for you. And Eisenhower was someone who worked a lot with LBJ and the Democrats across the aisle. Those were almost his better allies. So was that an influence on Nixon and his willingness to be like, yeah, I'll work with Democrats. Ike did.
Well, I think you look at it. I mean, I don't think there's a great deal of difference between Nixon and, say, John F. Kennedy, between Nixon and Lyndon Johnson. You know, the Eisenhower administration, and a key part of that was Vice President Richard Nixon, who at the time, Vice President was not, didn't have a West Wing office. Vice President was considered a kind of quasi-legislative branch official whose base of headquarters was really on the Senate side of the Capitol. He worked closely with LBJ. And I think in a way, one of Kennedy's most brilliant political techniques was during a campaign. I think he did it against Nixon in 60 with the missile gap. And I think he did it against Lodge for the Senate in 52. Kennedy actually had this technique of shifting to the right of his Republican opponent. And it so discombobulated his Republican, because that's so unnatural a position to find yourself in. They really didn't know how to respond. And so, you know, their private writings suggest that actually, not only were they friendly, they were friends, they got along, they saw eye to eye on a lot. Now, don't get me wrong, they would have been happy to see the end of the other's career. I mean, politics is Mortal Kombat. But I do think that there was a sort of kindred spirit among them, that these were serious players at the height of their game, titans of their own parties, of their own era. And I think there was a certain respect among thieves that they were the very best. And a realization that in politics, you are humiliated today, you conquer tomorrow. And with that shift of like majority, minority, and you've been in government long enough, you realize that the person I just humiliated, I might need him tomorrow, you know, when their heel is on my neck.
you mentioned how on the tapes you will hear that there were some domestic policies Nixon was really behind. What were some of the, what achievements was Nixon most passionate about in that arena?
That's a great question. And I think his own answer has changed over the years. You know, you can, for example, go to the tapes and find one body of evidence. You can look at his memoirs. He didn't really do an oral history, but these interviews he did with Frank Gannon in the early 80s, which are at the University of Georgia, he might say something a little different. And then he had a post-presidency, unlike Johnson and unlike Kennedy. He had 20 years to think about things and read and try to make sense of what he lived through. And so he was on Larry King and he was on all the talk shows and all that. And so he was asked that exact same question all the time. I've heard it different ways. I rewatched a Larry King episode in the last couple months. I think it was from 1992. Of course, Nixon dies in April of 94. So he lives almost 20 years after he resigns in disgrace in August of 74. And I was surprised by his answer. He says to Larry King that his most important accomplishment, he didn't say domestic policy. He said most important, period, was the war on cancer in 1971. Wow. Because he felt that impacted more human lives than anything else. Oh. And I thought, that's an interesting way to look at it. And I would not have answered, had until I saw that, had we had this interview 6 months ago, I would not have thought that. On another one, he talked a lot about women, bringing women into government, which is a focus this with Women's History Month, and Pat Nixon's birthday is March 16th, which happens to be tomorrow from the day we're recording this.
Yeah.
And so it's a whole weekend extravaganza now at the Nixon Library. And Nixon not only brought women into government, he appointed kind of this is my term, not his. He appointed kind of a czar for women, that we need to get the numbers up. In 71, he suggested Mildred Lilly for the Supreme Court. In 71, a decade before Sandra Day O'Connor. And Nixon on the tapes, you can hear him saying, the problem is, is that there's not enough women in the sort of, I'm going to use a baseball analogy, kind of the farm team, the farm system of the courts. You know, because you're often looking at the appellate court to go up a level to the Supreme Court or maybe the federal district court, but you've got to have the farm team loaded with talent. And Nixon won. And then I found a memo in 69 where Nixon says, he mentions we need to get a woman on the court when Warren steps down. Because, of course, Warren does. They bring in Warren. They bring in Warren Burger. The Burger era of the court starts at that point. And Nixon says, we need to look at a woman. And then he writes a postscript. Even better if it's an African-American woman. He said, that's two for one. Now, it's that's a bit of political callousness and calculation. But this shows you from the beginning, what in the, Mildred Lilly was a Democrat. It was known at the time. I mean, this was a time period, it's hard for us to imagine, when there was a Jewish seat on the court, when presidents typically would knowingly appoint members of the other party to achieve ideological balance. FDR and Truman both did that. Nixon wasn't turned off in the least that Mildred Lilly she was a Democrat as far as he knew. But he thought it was the right thing to do. And obviously he had other votes he could rely on. He puts Rehnquist on the court, you know, in 71. So he's got other allies he can go to. Yeah. But you gotta, this is not 2024. This was a different era. And I think Nixon, you know, the irony of the Nixon presidency ultimately, and this again, this is kind of cutting edge. A book has not been written about this. Yeah. If anything, Nixon, this super partisan figure, wasn't partisan enough. If only he had been more partisan, I think he would have survived Watergate.
Yeah.
The lesson of impeachment, whether it's Clinton, whether it's Trump, is you've got to take care of your partisan base because you need those 35 votes in the Senate to block removal from office. Yeah. And Nixon did all these progressive things as president, whether it be, you know, engaging with communists, ending the war, whether it be making friends with the Chinese and the Russians, setting aside foreign policy, then all this domestic policy, and the consistent thread is that it was conservative Republicans who were unhappy. So at the moment Nixon really needed congressional support during Watergate, he didn't have it. He didn't take care of his base because he never imagined he would need it. So I think this speaks well of him as a president and as a national leader of the country. But obviously doesn't speak well of him as a political leader because he didn't survive. He never imagined that calculus that he would need in the Senate.
Absolutely. And it's so funny because it's the last thing you expect when you start studying Nixon because of the caricature that's in your head of this boogeyman. And then you find a guy who's actually kind of in the middle and you're like, what? So I'm curious, I could be wrong on this, but it sounded, something you said earlier, you referred to Nixon as kind of the last liberal president, so it sounds like we might agree here. It feels like no administration since Nixon's has seen as much progressive legislation signed. Am I taking crazy pills, or is that accurate? And if so, why?
If you have some extra crazy pills, I could need you to get through this year, and I hope you have enough to go around for your audience. But, you know, I think the answer to your question, it takes historical perspective to answer that question that we don't have, you know, and I say that because even in Nixon's case, we're having a conversation now, 50 years removed. I'm guessing neither one of us were around at that time period.
Good guess.
And, you know, so we weren't on a college campus. We weren't drafted against our will to serve in a war. You know, that Nixon history 1.0 was all Watergate for 10, 20 years. And then you have what I call 2.0, where you have kind of the light and the dark. The dark is Watergate and everything that went on there, abuses of power. But the light is, oh wait, there was more that went on in 5.5 years. And mainly that became China and Vietnam and the Soviet Union. And only very recently now are we turning to domestic policy. So I don't know what we're gonna call this history in the future. But, you know, I look at it like I was thinking about, you know, after I got out of college just about the Bush 43 era, I think he did actually surprisingly a number of progressive things. AIDS assistance to Africa, they say might have saved 15 million lives. I mean, it's still, and now Congress won't reappropriate the funding for it. Are you kidding me? I remember Republican friends during Bush 43 saying, we kind of miss Clinton having a real conservative in the White House. You know, I mean, whether it be a huge agricultural bill to help farmers, whether it be, I remember Medicare with prescription drug funding, kind of bringing that into Medicare. I mean, he did a lot of, I mean, for his era, we might look back, you know, add to the clock another several decades, and we might say that for its time was a fairly progressive period. But also, we don't know what comes next. I mean, already the wars of Watergate, frankly, are beginning to look a little quaint, you know, compared to the recent political wars. And I don't want to imagine a world where my 9-year-old daughter lives 50 years from now, where the wars of today begin to look quaint compared to the future political wars. Yeah. But I think the lesson of human history is that's the track that we're on.
How did Nixon's relationship with Congress evolve over the course of his administration? You make the point he didn't have allies toward the end, but especially as Congress picked up the thread on Watergate, you know, did the domestic achievements, did the legislation start to drop off as Congress instead focused on Watergate?
Well, I think Nixon's evolution in Congress is obviously he understands better than you or I that when he's sworn in on January 20th, he doesn't have the House or the Senate. So he's going to have to get along. And so what Nixon thought about, they back then they called it, we're not going to get a Republican majority, they concluded, obviously. They hoped to chip away a bit at the Democratic, at least make it close. But the goal instead was to craft what they considered to have an ideological majority. That actually a lot of conservatives in the Democratic Party, some of whom were to the right of Republicans, that together we could cooperate on issues and think of it more like not like a party line vote, but more of like an ideological vote. And so, you know, you have conservatives in the Democratic Party. And by the way, I mean, you look at the list of prominent conservatives back then, they're almost all Southern and they're all chairs of some powerful committee, especially in the Senate. And so conservatives, I think, after Civil Rights Act of 64 and after Voting Rights Act of 65, at some point, you know, I don't want to say they ever, the tension they have with those issues ever goes away, but they sort of gradually stop talking about them. And instead, in the South, they start focusing on national defense and bringing military, like Richard Russell, bringing all his defense installations to Georgia. And Strom Thurmond, I'm worried about textiles and free trade and what's Japan do to the calculus in the 1970s. And so they kind of shift to other areas that are more natural ones for cooperation across the aisle because they're really more ideological. We forget sometimes that, you know, we look at party labels or party talking points, that an awful lot that happens in Washington happens for selfish personal reasons at the end of the day. You know, you want to talk about strange parts of the political continuum. It's not two-dimensional. You take a look at like 2016, the current populist movement in both parties actually kind of reaches around in the back and touches. You know, you take like the Bernie Sanders voters have in common with the Trump voters in 2016. Mm-hmm. They're concerned about China and jobs and free trade. Yeah. I mean, that is a very strange part of the political spectrum, but that's the one to really keep your eye on because a similar configuration could decide what happens this year. And so what I'm trying to argue is party labels are important, but ideology also matters, you know, an awful lot. People, the huge number of people this year who won't admit who they're actually voting for, or at least won't say it honestly, and whether, you know, never Trump is bigger than never Biden, it might be the question of the entire year. But in Nixon's time period, I think he had ideological allies. Nixon was the first president since I think it was about 1840, in the mid-19th century, to be elected president and not have either the House or the Senate during at any point of his presidency. Yes. That's a big difference. Yeah. So you have to find areas to cooperate. And as I say, Nixon no more ended the Great Society than Eisenhower did the New Deal, despite the fact that Eisenhower and Nixon people to his right were desperate, you know, to kind of retake government. Nixon didn't do that. I think those were kind of baked into government. They were accepted. We're going forward with them. We're going to try to make it a bit more efficient going forward and shade it more of a Republican kind of market-driven way. But I think that was basically Nixon's framework, is do what's possible.
Did the existence of liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats make it easier to get things done in Congress back then? Today, you know, it's each party's much more ideologically, you might say, pure than it was back then.
Yeah, this is a book that I wish could be written. You know, how did we get to this divided era? I think part of it is beginning in the early 70s, you're beginning to have more gerrymandered congressional districts. We're being kept apart from our neighbors, you know, I mean, for political calculations to also favor incumbents. Incumbents have gotten much stronger. Are there other reasons? What extent is the media dividing us rather than informing us? I think you're doing an admirable service here.
But what about, thank you.
But what about some of the other options, you know, around mm-hmm. the spectrum? Social media. I mean, we could mm-hmm. talk for an mm-hmm. hour on social media. I mean, I think there's lots of ingredients baked into why we've become so divided. I don't know that there's one. I have not seen an explanation that really helps to explain this. But I think in Nixon's time period, again, it was different. I think Nixon was kind of the end of the line. Ford was much more cautious, you know, inheriting that presidency from Nixon. And I think Carter was, again, it made sense. To me, it makes sense that you would have these kinds of short-term leaders, a Republican and a Democrat in the 70s, because both parties are in a process of consolidating and figuring out where do we go from here. And I think similar to today, in a way, you know, in anticipation of an election like 1980, I don't think we get out of this seesaw battle that we have in government today unless one side wins in a semi-dominant fashion. I don't mean a landslide, but I mean White House, you know, more than 50-50, more than winning the popular vote and losing the Electoral College. I mean, an election outcome that people aren't protesting and claiming is false. Because I remember, and when I was in my early 20s working in the Speaker's office, a lot of Democrats refused to accept the outcome of the 2000 election because the Supreme Court had intervened and sort of created a path for Bush to become president.
Yeah.
And I don't know what else they could have done. I don't like what they did, but I can't suggest a better outcome. And obviously many more Republicans recently are also denying the outcomes of elections. And we're at this point, both parties are sort of in pre-denial. If this, then that, we're prepared to deny the coming election. So I think we need to get to a point where it's decisive enough that even if you take into account, there's probably fraud in every election to some degree. That's not the question. The question is it enough to have mattered in the outcome? And I don't think that's usually the case. Mm-hmm. A 60 election, I don't know, maybe. Some historians say maybe that was one where it did matter. But we need to get to the point where the winner wins by enough, where even if you take into account the claims of fraud by the other side, they still would have won. And they have the ability to govern. And I think going back for 10 years or more now, we haven't had that.
You mentioned earlier you have a 9-year-old child. I'm expecting my first kid right now. So thank you very much. When I look at all the vetoes of Nixon's administration, the one that I just keep looking at was a veto of free universal child care. And I'm like, damn it. Are there any other bills he vetoed that would have radically changed the country we live in today?
Well, and on that one, I don't know the particular political calculus. And, you know, this happens all the time. The left wing of the Democratic Party is against a Democratic bill because it's not liberal enough.
Sure.
The conservatives are against a conservative bill because it's not conservative enough. And so it's hard to know exactly what the political calculus was there. Obviously, the Democrats had nearly the votes to override a veto with all of their votes and a few crossovers. So you don't know exactly kind of at what point that fell apart or what the issue was. And Nixon vetoed, I think I calculated, somewhere around 25 bills total. Mm-hmm. I mean, not a lot. I think you got to consider his political reality. The numbers are against you. You've got to find area. If you're going to use the veto pen, you've got to save that up for when you really want to use it. And I would think, you know, I also don't know. I mean, there's also political calculations. There are also those members who say, you know, I'm for the bill, but I'm running for re-election this year. And if I don't vote against it, I'm going to lose.
Right.
And you know, I'm with you if you need my vote, but if you're not, I'm going to vote against it. So there's all kinds of weird, convoluted rules for things that happen in politics that, at least for me, I mean, politics for me is kind of like a kabuki theater where I'm sitting in the cheap seats looking at actors on a stage. I don't really know a lot of times kind of how it really happens behind the curtain.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't know that he had any big one. I mean, about 25 total. I don't see any particular pattern. Most of them are earlier in the administration. But you know, I look at it, you know, one of the bills I don't like that Nixon passed was, you look at the energy bill of 74, the 55 mile an hour speed limit. If anyone has taken a cross country trip, especially once you get about west of St. Louis and that everything opens up, the sky opens up, you know, you realize it's going to be a week until I get to the West Coast at 55 miles an hour, or at least it seems like it. Yeah. So that was the Energy Act of 1974. So, I mean, right to the end of his presidency, even while he's engulfed in the flames of Watergate, I think he stayed consistently true to that, as I call it, it's not elegant, but I call it that moderate to liberal internationalist wing of his party.
Yeah. As I mentioned at the top of the show, you run NixonTapes.org. You've mentioned you've listened to so many of those tapes. My sense is that the tapes generally show Nixon was a racist, paranoid man who could not handle alcohol. I feel like that's the short thrift you usually hear about the tapes. So, A, is that accurate to the guy who's listened to possibly more than anyone else? And B, do the unguarded moments of those tapes teach us anything about what Nixon felt about the domestic legislation being passed on his watch?
Yeah, so I think your summation there is typically what you find in the history books, at least, I mean, less so today, but I would say especially what I would call the journalist historians and the actual historians, more academic historians, in, let's say, several decades of Nixon history. You know, there is a pivot now. I feel like Nixon's getting a fresh look during the Trump years. Yeah. You know, I remember I've been in D.C. for a lot of June 17th, so the anniversary of the Watergate break-in in 1972. And I remember being there in 2022, so the 50th anniversary of the Watergate break-in. And I woke up in my hotel room, and this idea just occurred to me seemingly randomly. I don't want to think that I'm the kind of guy who dreams about Richard Nixon. But ideas come to me at odd moments. And I thought, today I realized is the first time in my life, and I'm in my mid-40s, where Richard Nixon is not the number one political villain anymore. and we're beginning to look away from that time period. And the people who were really against Nixon for various reasons, some with good reason, they're dying off. And they're not being replaced by people by the same number. And the ones they're being replaced by, they're thinking about other things, more contemporary problems. And so right now, even as we talk, I think there is a reconsideration, a revisionism going on of Nixon history, and I don't know where it's going to go. Yeah. It's going to a place that I can't really predict. And so I think I think this is a factual statement. I assume I have listened to more White House tapes, not just of Nixon, but beginning with FDR in 1940, who is the first one to tape in the summer of 1940 as he approached his very controversial third term, where he'd run against Wendell Willkie, who was expected to be a really tough challenger, through Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, and officially the government line is no one has taped yet since. And I assume that they have, but they've done it in different ways that we can't access, which could be a whole nother episode.
I was just reading the Bush Senior biography, and he just kept his own personal tape recorder at the end of every night, you know, to record into.
And so of these 4,000 to 5,000, depending on how you count, you know, hours, I would guess today, as we speak, the percentage that are transcribed and on the public record, I would guess about 5%. 5 to 7%. So how in the world can we make an overarching conclusion about any of these presidents with having such a small sample size? Yeah. I would say this about Nixon. I can clearly find clips of tapes where he's a racist. I can clearly find clips where he says anti-Semitic things. Mm-hmm. If I were to add up out of 3,400 hours how much content there is of this type, I would say less than 10 minutes, probably less than 5 minutes. Now, maybe you could argue somebody only needs to say it one time to reveal what they really think. And the sample size doesn't really matter. But I look at it like this. You know, Nixon was an equal opportunity hater on the tapes. Yeah. I can use that term. He complains about WASPs and Catholics and white guys and blue collars and women and Latins and French and Jews and African Americans and immigrants and you know, establishment figures. I don't think he complains about one group any more than he does about any other. He's often on these tapes venting. He's letting off steam, just like Johnson and Kennedy. It's stream of consciousness. People assume if you want to know what happened, here's the tape from any of these presidents. That's not really true. What the tapes show is a process, but not the conclusion. All these presidents, they tend to say very little about what they think definitively. And their job is really to feel out the other side and to have some extreme reaction to suggest almost like a straw man argument. Like, well, you think this is a terrible idea, right? And you say, oh, no, what I really think is that's the technique they use on the tapes. And so actually, the longer I listen to these tapes, my conclusion is how really not definitive. They're not definitive at all on lots of subjects. Mm. And how you learn much more about the process than what the result is or what the president thinks. And I think this is ultimately going to cause a fresh look even at Nixon and Watergate, because I think those tapes are a lot less conclusive than I think people 50 years ago who assumed only Nixon taped, only Nixon was paranoid enough to bug himself and others. I mean, the perspective has really changed in 50 years. Yeah.
I got one more question for you, and that is that Nixon is a fascinating and almost tragic figure to me in American politics. What is your favorite Nixon story that you think we maybe have not heard?
Oh, geez. We only have one daughter. And congratulations, by the way. I used to be a night owl and a workaholic. And at least in my experience, having a daughter makes me better in every way. I become more responsible, patient with coworkers. And maybe you're already there ahead of where I was at. But it's a wonder. The worst thing about it is they get up at dawn every day. The best thing about it is you're going to get up at dawn every day and you're going to get 2 or 3 hours of work done before any of your peers get any kind of work done who don't have kids. Mm-hmm. But I think if we had more than one kid, you know, to answer your question, it would be like saying, which is your favorite kid? And so there's not really an easy, I don't really have an easy answer. I think what inspires me about studying the 1960s, Johnson and Nixon, you know, you look at the number of books that continue to be churned out about Nixon and not other presidents. It's incredible. And I think Nixon himself, you know, who, again, his tapes said, you know, the press is the enemy. You know, the establishment is the enemy. You know, Henry Kissinger, write it on the chalkboard 100 times and never forget it. And he also said, and I think here's where he miscalculated, our contemporaries are never going to treat us fairly. It'll be the historians in 50 years. And here, it's been 50 years. Mm-hmm. And is it fair? Is it not? I think it's more fair than it used to be. Right. We're getting there. We're taking, I think, another fresh look at the Nixon years. And so what fascinates me about Nixon is I think he understood this in politics. That in politics, it's better to be hated than forgotten. Hmm. Because if you're hated, we're still wrestling with you. Yeah. We're still trying to figure out what we really think. We're still trying to figure out where you belong in our presidential rankings. We're still trying to figure out who were the other presidents like you and sort of what box do we put you in American history. And with Nixon, I'm not sure there is anybody else in his box. Nixon has, even in post-mortem life, has maneuvered himself into this fairly unique place in the American consciousness. And we're still talking about him, not necessarily because we like him or we hate him, although that often, you know, is a part of our conversations, but because the years of his presidency were consequential, for better or for worse. Yeah. And that's the way I look at it. And I look at it that the more that I know, the more that I have to learn. We have 500 hours of tapes that have never been released, more than Kennedy ever recorded in his entirety, almost as much as what Johnson recorded in his entirety, and millions of pages of records, especially Watergate, that have never been open. So I feel like, you know, whereas 50 years is normally enough time, the dust is settled, let's look back and figure out what really happened. With Nixon, I think this arc is a much broader curve. And I think we're gonna be still figuring out Nixon for lots of decades to come.
He's such a fascinating guy. If you've enjoyed this interview with Luke and want to learn more about Nixon, please visit Luke Nichter to find his numerous books on Nixon, the presidency, or the Cold War, and a link to his website on the Nixon tapes. You spell that LukeNichter.com. Thank you for your time, Luke.
Thanks. Enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Abridged Presidential Histories. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, tell your friends and family about the show, and write a 5-star review on your podcast listening platform of choice. If you'd like to support the show, you can look it up on Patreon or go directly to www.patreon.com/abridgedpresidentialhistories. This helps me buy books and pay to host the show, and thank you so much to everyone who's contributed so far. The music in today's podcast is a public domain recording of the United States Army Old Guard Fife and Drum Corps. In our next episode, on April 8th, not the 1st, I will talk to Nixon biographer Jack Farrell about the political campaigns of Richard Nixon and the development of the Southern Strategy, a plan to flip the Old South to the Republican Party by dog whistling on race. That's coming up next time on Abridged Presidential Histories.